to the fourth case, the United States versus Olson. Mr. Habermill.
Good morning, my name is Alan Habermill. I represent Lawrence Olson. He's the defendant and the appellant in this case. The issues I raised in the brief, I'd like to discuss two this morning, the search warrant and the sentencing issue. To start with the search warrant issue, as I pointed out in the brief, this court has recently addressed, I think, the same issue on several occasions. Specifically, the common thread I see between this case and Kurth and Peck is all involved warrants based primarily, if not entirely, upon words of an informant. That is to say, not a police officer who's done some kind of investigation, not some sort of physical investigation like a heat source search, a garbage search, anything like that. What you have is a person of unknown reliability, no previous track record, coming and making accusations about some other person claiming they're involved in serious criminal activity.
But when we look at the Peck case, there are some factors that distinguish it because there, the CI didn't discuss where the drugs would be located, the total amount of the drugs, the frequency with which the defendant sold drugs, or details concerning who the defendant was. And she alleged to be the defendant's girlfriend. So, you know, our situation here, we're not faced with the same type of situation.
Peck is different in some ways, but it's also, and in that sense, it's sort of a weaker case for me, but on the other hand, in some ways, it's stronger, as I thought I addressed in particular in the reply brief, because on the other hand, in Peck, you have, for instance, the informant claiming that the alleged criminal made direct statements to her, both about the nature of the substance and his intent to deliver them, which is absent from our case. That's, in essence, a confession from that defendant, which you don't see here. Also, Peck, because she did claim she was the girlfriend, you could at least assume she has some sort of contact with this person that might be a basis for the knowledge. Also, Peck, unlike, for instance, the informant in our case, Joseph Olson, was not a criminal herself. She was more actually, I'm sorry, the informant in Peck, I didn't mean to get confusing, did not appear to have been a criminal herself, but simply someone who observed activity, and this, I think, would tend to give her more reliability. The facts are not entirely all square because of the things you pointed out, Judge Williams, and that's why I rely more on Kurth, because Kurth really is pretty much down the line on the facts. But again, what I wanted to talk about was this common thread, and that is, how should the police deal with warrant applications that are based on informants?
But there are informants and then informants, you know, and these are all highly factually specific determinations. Joseph Olson is arrested for something very close to what this is all about, namely the fact that Mr. Olson has marijuana around his house. Joseph's very specific about where the marijuana is seen, a pound of it in the bedroom 2 days before, reports about the guns, reports that the uncle is a convicted felon. The officer reviews the records, says, yeah, that's true. I mean, there are past indications of his involvement in drug trafficking. So there's a certain amount of corroboration. There's direct observation on the part of the informant here that the police can rely on. I mean, it's pretty specific, actually. It's much more so than Peck.
It is, however, identical to Kurth in all of those respects, and this court explicitly rejected the Kurth affidavit. One thing I would like to point out, Joseph Olson was not...
Yeah, but in Kurth, there were pretty much conclusory statements. The informant said he saw the contraband, and there was no corroboration of the investigation, and not the specifics that we have here that Judge Wood just nailed here and outlined for us.
Well, again, first of all...
You know, Kurth is a failure to corroborate case,
right,
among other things.
Right.
Which is true in our case. The police did nothing to corroborate.
Except they did. They checked the slant. They checked, I think it was, the term was the slant, the confidential intelligence records that they kept.
What they said they...
And they looked at his prior records, and they saw that he had several priors for the specific drug that the warrant was for, marijuana.
First, to respond to both of those at the same time, then, the informant in Kurth specifically, was very specific. He said he had specifically been at Kurt's residence 2 days before. He gave the date, August 29th. He very specifically said there was weights of marijuana, 150 to 200 pounds, 2 pounds of meth, large bag of coke, 30 grand in U.S. currency. He was specific on all of those details, and he said how he knew it. He said he had been there personally. That's exactly what Joseph Olson said.
But here, in contrast, we have independent evidence that Olson is connected with marijuana.
No, there's
beyond
no...
What the, well, he's been, you know, the prior records that they looked at that I was just mentioning, intelligence reports that Olson was involved in possible drug trafficking, criminal history with some arrests and convictions. In other words, there's sort of outside indicators that this guy is, in fact, involved in the drug
business. Plus, there was that November 2002 when a concerned citizen, although we don't know a lot about the concerned citizen, stated that Olson was selling marijuana out of his home.
They don't know. We don't know anything about the alleged
concerned citizen. I understand that, but I mean, when we look at probable cause and whether it existed, we do have to look at all the facts that the court took into account, and maybe individually each thing would not be enough, but we have a number of factors here.
Well, you have factors, but not facts. That is to say, an unknown person simply called a concerned citizen who says something to the officer some months before is not a fact. It's a statement from an unknown person
that's
of unknown reliability.
If that's all we had, you would be golden. But
well,
we have more than that.
Well, all you have, the slant records simply say they contain some files about suspected drug dealing without saying anything about what's in the files or even whether it was found to be true or not. The criminal record, this court specifically said, isn't enough to corroborate. All that says is on some prior occasion the person may have committed a crime. All of Mr. Olson's priors in this case are quite old. They're years before this current incident. They don't say anything about whether in this day, when they're trying to get the warrant, he in fact is possessing drugs with intent to deliver them. And to infer that he is, because in the past he's been convicted of that years ago, is an inference this court specifically setting Kurth and Impeck are not allowed to make.
But of course, as usual, Mr. Hoffman, you can take each one of these things and show why that thing alone wouldn't be enough. But don't we have to look at the whole picture? We have to look at certainly Joseph Olson's statements, and it's not at all uncommon that other criminals are making these statements to the police, indeed maybe more often than not. But all these other things taken together, even if any one of them alone wouldn't be enough. When they start adding up, why isn't it probable cause?
Because you can add zero to itself as many times as you want to, and the result is still zero.
Why is it zero if you have, you know, there is a criminal history, there is a report,
Because a criminal history does not tell you, merely because the person had committed some crime in the past, that there is some greater probability of finding drugs in his house 5 or 6 or 8 years later. Because a statement from a so-called concerned citizen, when that person's citizen status has not been demonstrated, is in fact deemed by this court, under its rules, as a statement from a firm of unknown reliability, which by definition is not sufficient, because simply having records in a slant file without saying what they are is saying nothing at all. It's smoke and mirrors, and just because they can add those things in, it's make weight. It doesn't actually address the core issue.
So if we give you that there wasn't substantial evidence, how do you get around the Leon good faith problem?
All right. That is the problem I actually wanted to really get to talking to you about, very simply because this. As this court has said, if there's any point at all to be dealing with these search warrant cases, it's because you're trying to tell the police something about what they should and shouldn't be doing. Otherwise, this is just wasted time.
Step one, you're telling the police, go to the magistrate, you know, go mm-hmm. through the formalities. And in the Leon cases where there's a problem with the affidavit or a problem with the warrant, at least the police have done that much.
Right. All cases with Leon have warrants, though, or that we wouldn't be that far. That's a given. Okay. If there's any chance of getting past that, Leon didn't say warrants are good just because they're warrants.
Oh, no. It said you look at whether a reasonably well-trained officer would have known the search was illegal despite the judge's authorization. There is a test that has to be met.
But
I agree with you. I certainly admit that there are not many cases where the police can get around Leon.
And this is actually where I came in. If there's anything at all, it's because the common thread is that if you're going to rely on an informant of unknown prior reliability, or even a criminal who's of dubious reliability, It is incumbent on the police to go do something more by way of real corroboration, not some other anonymous snitches report in their file, not rumors that they've heard, not looking to see if the guy's been convicted 6 years ago, but to go out and do some actual police work. Search the garbage. Set up a controlled buy. Do a heat seeking. Do something more to get some actual evidence to give you some reason to believe the informant before you go to the magistrate.
Well, can you bootstrap, Mr. Habermill, the informant in this case because of the close relative situation? Does that give it a little more weight for good faith purposes, perhaps?
I don't think so. The informant in Peck was apparently a sister. He's a nephew. Joseph's a nephew, but he's a criminal. He's an armed robber and a mugger, and I don't see where that really gets him very far. And in any event, there's nothing in the affidavit to back up your particular point. If they thought there was something more to give that more credibility, then it should have been in the affidavit, and we do have to live with what's in the affidavit.
And just in Peck, I don't think it was a sister. I think it was the defendant's girlfriend.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. You're correct. It was the girlfriend. She had a personal relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Ms. Elke?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Stephen Elke. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney in the Western District of Wisconsin. With respect to the search warrant issue, I think your honors have it just right, and I think Magistrate Crocker and Judge Shabazz, in adopting the magistrate's recommendation, had it just right. Here you have someone who, after all, was going to into a house to rob his uncle because he thought he had marijuana there, and he gives very particular information about where it was. He had just been there 2 days before.
Does the record show where Joseph was arrested? A couple of days later?
No, it was that day, Your Honor. If I recall correctly, his mother had some concern about her vehicle, and that's how it got reported to the police originally, and it was almost serendipitous that an officer happened to see the vehicle, and then they go to the residence, and if I recall correctly, he was chased outside of the residence and arrested outside.
So he was more or less on the premises of Mr. Olds, or near the premises of Mr. Olds' house?
Yes, exactly where he was, Your Honor. I could not tell you, but more or less, I do not believe he was arrested inside of the residence, but it was a continuous sort of in the process of the robbery.
But yeah, the reason I ask is if it had been 2 days later at the shopping mall, that would have been one thing, but if it was right at the house, that would be a reason the police might think he knew something about the house.
No, it was sooner than that, Your Honor. If I recall correctly, the defendant in this case, the victim, if you will, in the underlying
right.
case, had been injured to some extent and was actually spoken to by officers while he was still injured, and I believe they asked him for consent to go in and look at the house, and he wouldn't allow that. So it was part and parcel of the same day, not 2 days later, although that's when the search warrant was applied for, obviously. Counsel is certainly correct that in and of themselves, maybe if all there was is corroboration were the prior drug arrests and convictions, that maybe, I'm not conceding that certainly, but maybe that wouldn't be enough. But here you have, and Magistrate Crocker, I think, goes through and does a nice job saying how each one of these is a little bit, but when you put them together, it's pretty compelling that you have good corroborative evidence of the information being provided, and it's certainly sufficient to establish probable cause for the search warrant.
Mr. Elke, do we know when a concerned citizen makes
as
the call?
Sorry, Your Honor. As it is in the affidavit, it was in November of 2002. I don't believe we have a specific date for that. I think that is found in Inspector Thomas's affidavit. She refers to November of 2002. A concerned citizen tells her about drug dealing, and at that point she opens an investigative file. Beyond that, I don't have any further date that it occurred. An issue that was not raised, at least in the oral argument, was certainly raised in the briefing, is this issue about the sentencing and the prior conviction. So I'd like to address that, if I might. The government, in reviewing this record and in reviewing the case for oral argument here today, would suggest to the court that the district court's ruling was not crystal clear in terms of what he was basing his decision on. In other words, whether it was the conviction or the underlying conduct. And I read it many times and tried to parse through it, and quite frankly, it's a little hard to know whether the judge was making a finding of fact or was basing it on the conviction alone. When you look at the entire record as a whole, it may very well, and when I say the whole record as a whole, I would say our submission beforehand, our concession, which I believe was wrong at sentencing, in which we were asked what's the most important point here, and we said it's the conviction you look at, Your Honor. I don't believe that's correct. I think it is the underlying conduct which should be looked at. If this court does believe that there was some factual determination by the court, then the clear error standard would apply, which is set forth in our brief. If this court does come to the conclusion, though, that the district judge was basing his ruling on the conviction standing alone, our position would be that this matter should then be remanded to the district court for further findings to determine and to flush out the question of whether the drugs were for possession for personal use or for possession with intent to distribute.
Weren't there witnesses that testified on behalf of the defendant that the drugs were used for personal use?
The record here, I think, Your Honor, to answer your question, needs to be fleshed out, quite frankly, a little more. On the one hand, you have a relatively small amount of drugs involved. You have 2 ounces of marijuana.
And how many bags were involved?
I would be guessing, Your Honor, but I think it's about 6. I think it's a half ounce and then two quarter ounces and then maybe 3 8-ball, 5 or 6, I believe. I may be wrong about that, Your Honor. But you have what I would say are conflicting inferences which could be drawn. You have a small amount of drugs on the one hand. On the other hand, it's packaged as if it were going to be for distribution. If the defendant's exhibit number 9, which was introduced at the sentencing, is the police report from the February 26, 1995 arrest, and attached to that are 2 handwritten statements, and parts of that would suggest that perhaps this 2 ounces was going to be used for personal use. And if I might, Keith Simonson, for example, question, did you know that there was marijuana in the car? Answer, yes. And whose was it? Answer, Larry's. Question, how did you know it was in there? Answer, he smoked some of it. He put some in a pipe and smoked it, and then the witness goes on to say that he did as well. And also Mr. Terry Simonson, in the middle of his, on the second page of his handwritten statement, one of the questions is, question, what marijuana, or whose marijuana was it that was found? Answer, Larry, it was in his possession. Put it that way, which is sort of an equivocal statement, I would say. And so it's unclear, I think, if we get back to the question of whether it was for personal use or for possession with intent to distribute, I think there needs to be more of a factual record made if the court concludes that the district court's decision was wrong in the sense that it was based solely on the conviction. We would suggest that it be remanded for further clarification, further hearing on that matter. But unless there are any further questions, that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Alfie. Mr. Habermill, you would use your time, but you may have a minute for rebuttal.
I'd like to address simply that last point very quickly. There is no evidence in the record that those multiple bags were being used for personal use. Mr. Olson had a separate small bag that fell out as he was being searched at the police station, a couple of grams, separate from those multi-package bags, and it's that, I think, that was being smoked. So you got 2 different things. I don't want that to get confused. It's always been our position in this case that the larger amount was being possessed with intent to deliver. Bear in mind, this comes during the same year that he was later charged with and convicted of that very same offense, the case that the government agreed was relevant conduct. Bearing in mind also, it's the government's position with which we agreed that Mr. Olson had been dealing marijuana for at least 10 years, and this possession that's at issue here fell squarely within that time frame. And so for all those reasons, I think it's clear, again, and given the bagging, the 1 ounce, the 2 quarter ounces, and the 3 smaller bags, that's not how you carry stuff for your personal use. Everyone knows that's how dealers carry stuff to sell. Very, very quickly, the one thing that the judge didn't do was actually make a personal factual evaluation and determination of the conduct. He started out by saying, It's a conviction for possession of marijuana, therefore it doesn't count. And his subsequent comments, I think, muddied the waters, did not clear them. But he's talking about what the state court did. The trial court himself never looked at this conduct itself, looked at the report and said, well, I find this or I find that. It never got that far in the analysis. And my only suggestion is I don't think we need to send it back to him to do that, because I think it's clear from the way that marijuana was bagged, its timing in relation to Mr. Olson's other drug dealing activities, and our own concession, which the government, you know, did not dispute that Mr. Olson was dealing marijuana during that time, that in fact that stuff was possessed with intent to deliver and therefore shouldn't have counted. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. Mr. Habermas, an additional thanks to you for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Olson.
Thank you.